The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have made engine start. 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Space Show Tuesday night program. And I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you for tuning in. I hope everybody had a terrific holiday weekend, and it is great to be back live with everyone. We're probably doing the 60-minute format tonight with Alan Boyle. So do plan on that. If we go a little beyond that, that's fine. Watch your clock. So if you do want to get a phone call in, or an email into Alan, make sure you time it so that you're not doing it after we've already closed down the program. So again, 60-minute format. Our toll-free number for tonight is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners, so let the phone ring. Be patient, and I'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. And then you can also reach us via email, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. You can also reach us through our blog, which is on our website, thespaceshow.com. And if you don't know how to use our blog to send a live question during a live show, please email me, and I will send you a short note of instructions on how to do that. But again, it's on our website. It is the archive show for today under upcoming show menu. And that and the email address, either one are fine. But the preferred way of communicating with our guest is always the toll-free number. So let me give it out one more time, 1-866-687-7223. Do check out our website newsletter. It is on pretty much the center of our homepage. And it is current. Make sure you look at the upcoming events that are planned as we're rapidly filling up. Well, second quarter is already filled up, so we're now marching through third quarter. If you have guest suggestions for us, please send them to me by email. And if you have the contact information for the person and why you're recommending the person, that would be a terrific help. And we appreciate that. Feedback in that assists very much. Everything we do is archived, so you can listen right off of our website or rapidly download our program. If you want the email newsletter sent to you at about 6 a.m. California time Monday morning, send me your email address. It's very short. It won't clutter up your inbox. I promise you that. A couple of other things. There is a menu on the upper left on our website, and there is a store there under support. So if you're interested in logo wear or something of that nature, that's where you will find it. There is also a listen live button in that upper left menu. This tells you how to listen to live shows, how to listen to compressed MP3 archive shows on our website, and how to do the podcast on different devices, as well as Alexa. So if you have any questions, don't hesitate to email me again, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Center right of the homepage, and this is probably the most important, is the fact that, again, I say this all the time, we are a listener-supported program. We are a 501c3 nonprofit with one, O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org. And we're able to bring you these programs because many of you do financially support and contribute to the Space Show. Remember, if you pay U.S. federal taxes, you get a tax deduction because we are a nonprofit 501c3. And the same is true for those of you who pay California taxes. We're a public benefit corporation in California. Our parent 501c3 company is one, O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org. Check it out. And if you want more information, email me at drspace at thespaceshow.com. And we definitely thank you for your gifts. There are PayPal instructions on our homepage, as well as instructions for those of you who don't want to use PayPal but would prefer to mail a check to the Space Show instead. And again, questions always are welcome. Dr. Space, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And normally at this point, I would read the sponsor messages, because we do have sponsors, and they get their banner ads going across our homepage, which they can change as frequently as they want. But on the shorter 60-minute programs, I only thank our sponsors. I don't read their full messages. So I do want to thank our sponsors for tonight, the National Space Society. They just completed their terrific ISDC 2018 program in L.A., and Alan's going to talk about that in just a few minutes. Also, the Space Development Network for Space Settlement Work is a sponsor, spacedevelopment.org. The Space Foundation, and that's spacefoundation.org. Or if you want to go check out the programs from their recent symposium, start out with spacesymposium.org. And then the Integrated Space Plan is a sponsor, and their website is thespaceplan.com. Orbital ATK is our sponsor, the AIAA, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, and also Celestis, the premier provider, maybe the only provider, of Memorial spaceflight services in the world. And Celestis is at Celestis, CELESTIS.com. So we are deeply appreciative of our sponsors. We would not be doing this show without them. And thank you all very, very much. As I said a few minutes ago, Alan Boyle is back with us. So he is an award-winning science writer and veteran space reporter. He was formerly at NBC News, and he's the author of The Case for Pluto, How a Little Planet Made a Big Difference. He's on the editorial team for GeekWire.com and is the aerospace and science editor. And you should absolutely be reading what he posts all the time and regularly on GeekWire. And it's not just space, but it's a lot of really good science information. That should be a major daily check for all of you. Alan was just at ISDC. He also sat down and did an excellent interview with Jeff Bezos, which you can get online, and that is on GeekWire. It went up today, I guess. It has today's date on it. The title of his article is Jeff Bezos, We Will Have to Leave This Planet, and It's Going to Make This Planet Better. Alan, welcome back to the Space Show. It's great to talk to you again. How are you?
Well, thank you, and thank you so much for the kind words. I really appreciate it. We've been around the block a few times, David, over the past couple of decades, and so I'm so glad to be back and be chatting with you.
Always a pleasure. So is the fact that the people leaving the planet are the people we want to get rid of, and that's why we're going to make this planet better? Or did Jeff have another explanation?
Well, I've already gotten some comments. Well, depending on how you feel about Amazon and Jeff Bezos and billionaires, some people might say, well, good riddance. But that was basically half the message. There's only so much you can put in a headline. But the idea is that we will leave the planet to put things into place so that you have the heavy industry, the factories, the things that are energy intensive aspects of our society. You can put that into space where you have space solar power. You might have people living in space, but they can always come back. They go back and forth. In fact, this is kind of why Jeff is not as sold as, say, Elon Musk on the idea of let's all go to Mars. That the idea is that outer space will become part of Earth's economic sphere, and yes, that will extend to Mars at some point, but a lot of people are going to want to go back and forth. And the idea is that Earth would be for residential and light industrial use. It would be kind of more of a park-like setting than it is now, and that space is where a lot of the industry would get done and then sent you would send the products that are created in space down to Earth. So it's an interesting perspective on it. He calls it the Great Inversion, where instead of having technology developed on Earth and then sent up to space, you know, in the form of the International Space Station or whatever, you have things that are produced in space and then sent back down to Earth.
And he really buys into this. This is really his belief system, correct?
Yes, it is. That's something that we discussed at the National Space Society meeting, the ISDC. It's interesting that he really has been inspired by Jerry O'Neill, who developed a lot of the ideas that we have about settlement in space. And in fact, the award that Jeff received was in recognition of space settlement advocacy. It's the O'Neill Memorial Award. And so that's why we spent so much time during the fireside chat on where these ideas got developed and how this has really been something that perhaps a lot of people didn't know about Jeff Bezos, how much he was formed by those ideas that he absorbed while he was growing up.
Does Jeff himself want to go into space? Does he want to go to Mars or the moon or live on a orbiting space station, space settlement? Did he express his own personal views about living in space?
Well, during this interview, we didn't really get into that, but during past interviews, including one that we had at the Space Symposium a couple of years ago, he said, yes, he would like to do that, but he'd like to do it on Blue Origin space vehicles. And so I have a feeling that just as Richard Branson says that he'll be flying on Spaceship Two, Jeff Bezos is likely to show up on one of these Blue Origin suborbital flights on New Shepard. Probably not the first one, but I'm pretty sure that he would want to take a ride at some point.
Does he have a plausible timeline for getting from where we are here today to where we need to be? I know that was one of your frequent questions to him in the interview that I read. What kind of timeline does he have for getting from here, 2018, to that vision he described and which you just repeated for us? Is this going to be 5 years, 10 years? Is it similar to Musk wanting to get to Mars right away? Is it longer term?
Definitely longer term than what Elon Musk has in mind. And it starts with those suborbital flights. I remember around the time of the Spaceship One flights, you and I were talking, and it seemed as if there was this two-year rule that was into effect, that it was always 2 years away
right. That
regular folks would be able to fly in space. And so that two-year rule is now starting to focus down to a matter of a year, maybe months. And in Blue Origin's case, they have said for some time now that they hope to start flying the first test astronauts, I guess you would call them, by the end of this year. And so you would have suborbital flights. As you know, Blue Origin has done uncrewed flights to space and back on a suborbital basis, and they hope to start putting people on those flights by the end of the year and perhaps begin commercial operations next year, although they haven't started taking reservations and they have not set the ticket price for these flights yet. So it'll be interesting to see between Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic how that suborbital space market. Some of them will be tourists. Some of them will be researchers who want to do zero-G research. And so it's not all tourists, but there will be a fair amount of tourists. That's where a lot of the demand is going to come. And then you've got the New Glenn orbital class rocket that Blue Origin is developing. They've got a huge factory in Florida that they have they've built and they're starting to ramp up operations there. They hope to have their BE-4 engine certified and have the first rocket flying in the New Glenn series in 2020. And so after that, things get a little more fuzzy. They have the Blue Origin. Blue Origin has the Blue Moon lander program, and that could start landing on the moon in the mid-2020s, perhaps 2026. That's when NASA would like to have a large lander that's capable of taking people to the surface of the moon available. And what we discussed during the interview was in a matter of decades, you'll see this process unfold where manufacturing in space becomes more and more realistic, and people are starting to get into that. But he did say that in a matter of a few decades to 100 years, we're probably going to see the pressure on energy consumption and the environmental concerns develop to a degree that you would see start to see this great inversion. And so I guess for that to start kicking in would be a century. And he has said that in order for this process to fully mature, that could take a century, maybe a couple of centuries, you know, hundreds of years. So it's not as if we're all going to be living in O'Neill habitats by 2030. I think he's got a little more realistic time frame than Elon Musk, but I think that Elon Musk has more of a drive to, you know, get this done in the next decade or so. So who knows, we might see Blue Origin active on the moon with the Lunar Initiative, and we might see Elon Musk pressing onward to Mars, probably with some support from NASA. But it'll be an interesting decade.
In your interview with Bezos, he reiterated many times that he's a firm believer in sort of a step-by-step I'm adding the word incremental, but incremental approach. So he wants to go slow, methodically, and step by step all the way. So that's why he has a focus on suborbital, to learn what he's doing and fire that engine, you know, many, many, many times and step by step.
That Elon Musk has kind of gone directly to orbital and is working on getting that Dragon spacecraft certified for NASA flights, and so it's a different approach, and definitely SpaceX is farther along the way than Blue Origin right now, if you're judging by what's being launched where. And so that is an interesting difference in approaches. Jeff Bezos seems to be comfortable with the approach that he's taking. In fact, the mascot of Blue Origin is the tortoise. And so that immediately brings to mind the story of the tortoise and the hare. And so if we're going to tell that story when it comes to space development, Blue Origin is definitely the tortoise, and you can guess who the hare would be if Blue Origin were telling that story.
You know, absolutely. You have a listener email, and this is Ben, and Ben is in Flagstaff, Arizona, and he says, Alan, I have a strange question. If you don't want to answer it, that's fine. I assume you have been to conferences where both Elon has spoken as well as Jeff has spoken. Is there any way you can judge the overall popularity of these two guys? Does one have more popularity than the other?
I've been to a number of conferences, and I've been to, for example, the Guadalajara conference where Elon Musk spoke, and I've just been to ISDC here and a couple of other events where Jeff Bezos has spoken. And Elon Musk definitely has more of a rock star following. It's almost problematic how much fan interest there is in anything that Elon Musk has to say. People line up basically for blocks to get in. And I remember in Guadalajara, it was just a stampede of people once they opened the doors for people to find a seat. So that is something I haven't seen with other space events, including events where Jeff has been. That tends to be a more controlled environment. People are interested. It is interesting, during the ISDC meeting, Jeff showed up probably about an hour early, and he was mobbed by the people who happened to be there in the hall. And one reason for that is that there was this science fiction show called The Expanse,
right,
that had been recently canceled by Sci-Fi. And so everyone was trying to press for either Amazon or Netflix to pick it up, and that turned out to be kind of the surprise opener for our talk in Los Angeles. Is I was going to start asking him about Jerry O'Neill and his influence, because he had just received the O'Neill Award, and then he said, "Yeah, I'll answer that question, but first there's a little thing I want to take care of. Is anybody familiar with the show called The Expanse? And did you know that the cast of The Expanse is out here in the audience?" Because the cast of The Expanse had just participated in a panel discussion on the science behind that particular show, and so they had showed up at the banquet. And he said, "Well, we've been. I told the cast that we are trying as much as we can at Amazon to keep that show alive. And 10 minutes ago, while I was at dinner, I just got the word that The Expanse is saved. And after that, he could have said anything and they'd be cheering him." So that was quite a way to bring an audience over to your side. And so I think after this weekend, just because of that, just because, interestingly, because of what another one of Jeff Bezos's ventures did, I think his stock rose a little bit. And, you know, Blue Origin, it's important to point out, is Jeff Bezos's personal venture. It doesn't benefit directly from Amazon, but what Jeff does is that he sells $1 billion worth of Amazon stock every year and puts most of that toward supporting Blue Origin.
Are you a fan of The Expanse? Do you watch it?
I do, yeah. I'm a little bit behind on the current season. It's the third season, so I've just kind of been dipping into it. So if anybody is going to try to come up with any spoilers, please don't, because I'm just into the third season right now, and don't spoil it for me.
I've never gotten into watching it. I guess maybe I should try to start over again and see if I can sit through it and watch it. It never really appealed to me. So,
well, yeah, that's okay too. You know, some things catch your interest, some things don't. For Jeff, he's a big fan. He said that he was a big fan of the show. He's a big fan of the Culture series by Ian Banks. That's actually one of the questions that I asked, is how much of a science fiction fan he is, and he's a huge fan. He says that it's a real mind expander, and he continues to indulge his science fiction reading habit. So kids, keep reading. You know, someday you could be a billionaire too, I guess.
Is there anything that was new to you from your interview with Jeff, or that people may not have known about, other than The Expanse? Is there something about Blue that we didn't know about that we should know about?
Well, there were a couple of things that came out that were new twists for me, and things that I wanted to ask about. I was particularly interested in how committed he was to doing things other than the things that are the focus of the venture right now. You know, that right now Blue Origin is primarily a propulsion company, and so they build engines, they build spacecraft that get you places, whether it's New Shepard or New Glenn or this future super large rocket that they talk about called New Armstrong. And so maybe the one thing that I wanted to find out is whether Blue Origin was willing to do other things, you know, build rovers, build habitats, build all the other types of hardware that you're going to want if you want to do settlements in space. And the answer was that, yes, Blue Origin will do that. They'll do whatever it takes. Jeff has talked about having Blue Origin build the heavy lifting infrastructure that other companies can use to go out into space. And he said that he doesn't necessarily want to do other lines of space business. He would like to see other companies build on the infrastructure, just as Amazon built on the infrastructure that was created by the credit card companies or the delivery companies like UPS or FedEx. But he, if need be, they would continue to expand into other things that need to be done to make that space settlement vision come true. And he's willing to do that even if it's not supported by NASA. You know, some people have talked about, well, here's this billionaire. Why should he need NASA funds to do it? And he's saying, well, things are going to go more quickly if NASA funds the sorts of things that Blue Origin does. But even if NASA doesn't provide funding in a public-private partnership, Blue Origin would do what needs to be done. So more committed, I think, than I would have thought. And I guess we'll have to see how that plays out. But I found that interesting. And another little twist was in discussing New Glenn, the orbital rocket, that is supposed to have the booster come back from space, just as SpaceX's Falcon 9 has the first stage booster come down and land itself. Uh-huh. It could land on a ship. And so it's a similar system for New Glenn, that booster is going to land on a ship. And so I just asked, hey, have you bought the ship yet? And he said, actually, we have. We're retrofitting it right now. So I found that interesting. That was a little snippet that I don't think people knew before, that they are proceeding with that particular piece of infrastructure for the launch routine.
Larry is in Denver with an email question. And listeners, again, the phone line is available, 866-687-7223. Larry says, I read the interview on GeekWire, so I was surprised that he was supportive of the NASA policy that seems to be I'm editing the email as we go. What he's saying is he's surprised that Jeff said supportive things about our plans to go back to the moon, because there's so much criticism of the plans going back to the moon, including LOPG. But Jeff seemed to be really positive and supportive of the administration and the Space Council. And what he wants to know is, did he say anything privately to you off the record about LOPG or the delay in plans that might be taking us back to the moon?
Well, first of all, I didn't really have any off-the-record discussions with Jeff, so it's all out there. The way that these things work is that he gets on to the stage and I come out, and it's all on the table, and then he left quickly after the event ended. The one thing he did say after we got off stage was that he enjoyed the interview, which that's good in my book. Some people would think, well, you got to really hold the person's feet to the fire, but in this case, I think you really want to have the experience enjoyable and challenging for me and for the interviewee and for the audience. And I feel like it was successful on that front, that this is the sort of situation where you don't want to have the interviewee be uncomfortable. And I think it was enjoyable for everyone concerned. So in terms of the Moon Initiative, he did say that he was really supportive of the idea of going back to the moon. We didn't really get into the details, you know, whether G is the lunar orbiting platform gateway or LOPG the way to go, or is there some other way to do it? In fact, one of the interesting things that came out of ISDC was Robert Zubrin's Moon Direct plan, where you send things directly to the lunar surface, and in Zubrin's view, LOPG is totally the wrong way to go. And so I think as the initiative moves forward, I suppose there will be some room to consider what the infrastructure is going to be. And I think JEP is focusing on New Glenn and the ability to use the Blue Moon Lander on SLS or New Glenn or Atlas V or whatever it takes. But I don't think that he is super wedded to the idea of having this orbiting outpost in a particular orbit around the moon. I don't think that. I think that would be a whole nother discussion. What he thinks about those details of the plan.
You have a caller. Let me take us to our caller.
Sure.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is Marshall in Oklahoma. And,
okay.
I have been interested in what is going to replace the International Space Station, and I was kind of wondering what Jeff Bezos would like to do in something like a equatorial low Earth orbit space station. Has he got any ideas, plans, or a friend that's hot on it?
I don't think that he's focused on that. Going back to the earlier part of this discussion, I don't think that he would rule out having an outpost, but I have a feeling that he would see that as one area where there are a lot of actors talking about things already, whether it's the official program for this lunar orbiting gateway, or the sorts of things that, say, NanoRax has in mind. NanoRax has a big initiative to have converted Centaur upper stages turned into the infrastructure for space habitats or outposts. And so I think that Blue Origin would probably say that's not our focus
if
right now.
If you'd like to make a call, please hang up and try again.
Alan, looks like we dropped some phone calls, including Marshall. Everybody, just stay put, and I will get Alan right back on the phone, and I apologize for that.
Hey, hello.
Hi, Alan. Sorry about that.
No problem.
Okay.
Yeah.
Listeners, we're back with Alan. We also lost Marshall. Marshall may be back on the line. Let's see if he called back.
Please hang up and try again.
No. We lost.
I think that's the answer, though. I think we got that question answered, is that that's not a priority for Blue Origin to develop low Earth orbit space outposts. That's something that other companies are covering pretty well.
Despite his affinity for O'Neill, who had orbiting space stations, that's not his thing.
He would say that's not my focus right now. You know, if it turned out that that's something that needed to be done and nobody else was doing it, I think that he, in line with what we've previously talked about, he would try to see what needed to be done. But I have a feeling that that's one area where there are a lot of players involved already. And this is one thing that he did stress, is that it's not going to be up to just one company. If you're going to have a successful space industry, you're going to have 1,000 companies, just as the Internet has spawned 1,000 companies.
Marshall, if you were satisfied with the answer, fine, but I don't know why we lost your phone call, but if not, feel free to call us back. And listeners, a toll-free number is available if you want to use it, 1-866-687-7223. Alan, we can continue to take emails and calls about Bezos at ISDC, but what else went on? I mean, their list of keynote speakers alone was very, very impressive. I had the list, and who did you see? What did you learn? I mean, what was really an eye opener, or was there one for you?
Well, I'll talk about kind of some of the subjects that I found fascinating. This whole idea of space settlement, just because in part what Jeff Bezos had to say about it, but also because we're kind of heading in that direction, and I think more and more people are realizing that space settlement is going to be a big factor, especially if Elon Musk's plans for settlement on Mars take shape. So there were several folks, of course, Robert Zubrin, as I mentioned, was there, and Pascal Lee from the Houghton Mars Project had some really interesting presentations on ideas for settlement, not only on Mars, but on the moon as well. And so lava tubes, the idea that you have these protected areas beneath the surface with skylights or openings that you could use to gain access to these protected areas, that was a really interesting topic to mull over that came up in several presentations. The whole idea of how you administer settlements on the moon or Mars. Some folks have ideas for creating economic development zones and how that would be administered internationally. We talked about the moon village. On the SETI front, Frank Drake was one of the keynote speakers, received an award, and he talked about the whole history of the SETI program and what's coming up next, where they're developing systems that would monitor the entire sky all at once using Fresnel lenses to expand the search and have that intensify. And there was another day-long symposium, basically, on how you create messages to send to perhaps alien civilizations. What's the best message? We've had decades of experience going back to Voyager and Pioneer, and how you design messages that someone coming in from another planetary system might be able to understand. And of course, we've had the movie with Amy Adams called Arrival, which really lays out that scenario. What if the aliens arrive? How do you communicate with someone whose cognitive system is built differently? And so, believe it or not, that was one of the subjects that came up. Is there a universal language, can you design something that reflects principles that could apply to an alien way of thinking? So, a lot of provocative stuff going on. One of my favorites was a presentation by a guy who is building a self-sustaining habitat in the Columbia Gorge, which is, you know, relatively close to where GeekWire is headquartered, and just the whole idea of trying to prototype space farming. And so this guy is developing an aquaponic system that includes using organic waste as an energy source. And it really is kind of an attempt to do in real life what astronaut Mark Watney did in the fictional Martian in the movie that made such a splash a couple of years ago.
Do you remember the guy's name?
It's the last name is Raymond, and I think that let's see if I can if you want to kind of keep the conversation going, I'll get back to you with more details about the contact and the website. So
yeah, he might be a good space show guest. You have a caller. Hi caller, welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you, please?
This is Marshall. Sorry about that. There's a thunderstorm rolling in.
Okay, so that's probably
knocked me off the air.
Okay.
I'm glad he moved over and started talking about hydroponics and space farming. I would really like to know about that. Unfortunately, I called back just before he said something. My question is, has anybody come up with the perfect diet for people in space so that they could live permanently there? So run with it. I'll drop off the line before the thunderstorm blows me away again.
Thank you, Marshall.
Bye.
Hey, Alan, before we get to the perfect diet in space, does anyone have the perfect diet for living here on Earth? Because I'm having trouble finding the perfect diet for everything here on Earth, let alone going to space. So,
amen. Amen to that. I could use some help on that myself. But this gentleman's name is Jeff Raymond. And,
okay.
And he has a YouTube channel for The Real Martian. And so if you do a search on The Real Martian and YouTube, you'll probably catch up with that. So
okay.
He has regular updates on how he's putting this habitat together. And it's quite an adventure. It involves raising fish, and it involves raising greens that are part of a self-sustaining system that you could do on Mars using LED lighting, and it's really quite a. an adventure. You really get down in the dirt, literally, and all the problems that he's had with his solar energy system and the digester that turns organic waste into biogas and how you raise the fish in these aquaponic farms. And one of the things that they do is that they raise a lot of salad greens and sell those to the local restaurants. And so he figures that he's one or two contracts away from breaking even on this whole operation. And he's got a day job also that he happens to work for in situ, which is a Boeing subsidiary that works on drones. And so he's doing all this homesteading and Martian prototyping in his evenings and weekends and off hours. So it's quite a commitment, and so hats off to him. But if you do a search on The Real Martian on YouTube, you'll catch up with him, and I hope to go down there and see it for myself.
Does he have an email address? Did you get that contact information?
Yeah, I will. I'll get that to you, David.
I don't
want to say anything on the air.
That's fine.
To that extent, but I'll definitely get that to you.
Oh, absolutely. Anything else at ISDC that stood out from your perspective? The business plan section, did you go to any of that work or any of the commercial space activities that were planned?
I did, there was just so much on the business plans. I caught up with the tail end of that, and actually the winner of the business plan competition, don't press me for the name. I don't recall it off the top of my head, but it was a venture that sought to automate a lot of the paperwork that has to be done for getting ready for space operations. And I was really surprised that sometimes the final frontier for space ventures is the red tape and how you deal with that. And this particular venture, that was their focus, is helping deal with the earthly paperwork that you need to go through to get into space. What struck me also was just how much goodwill and fan base there was for Buzz Aldrin. We're coming up on a string of 50th anniversaries, and Buzz still has got it. You know, he just draws a crowd wherever he goes. He's one of the space industry's treasured celebrities, and so that really struck me how much that vision of Apollo continues to capture the attention and the goodwill of the next generation. Let's see. Yeah, those are the top things. Virgin Orbit was there. Rocket Labs. There are a lot of, you know, it's just a very active community, particularly in the launch industry, and I don't know if everybody's going to make it, but everybody has plans to find their niche in the launch industry and providing space services. So it's very active. I think that the activity level is getting higher and higher. So I think that we're either going to see a real phase change in the space industry, or we're going to see a lot of these ventures find out that the demand that they hoped was there is not going to be there, and there might be a little bit of a reality check set in. But I hope it's the former. I hope that this is an indicator that the space industry is really starting to take off, so to speak, based on everything that's progressing.
Cam is in Des Moines with an email question for you. And Cam says, do you have any sense at all that Bezos or Blue or any of the people that you spoke to are possibly concerned about an increasingly onerous regulatory environment, or is that issue behind everybody?
I think with the new administration, that there is quite a push to reduce the regulatory load, and so I think that is one part of this whole system that is really improving, and there's a recognition that we have to streamline things, and there's a lot that's being done with the Commerce Department to turn that into what they call a one-stop shop for licensing and trying to get things moving more quickly. And so there's a sense on the part of a lot of ventures that things are moving in the right direction to facilitate more business in the space industry. So I think that's a real positive development.
Linda is in Spokane, not too far from you. Were any of the traditional big aerospace companies there, such as Boeing, ULA, Orbital, etc., or is it mostly new space, commercial space, entrepreneurs, more innovative on the smaller size?
Definitely the emphasis is on smaller, newer ventures. There were some folks from United Launch Alliance there. I didn't spend a lot of time with Boeing or Orbital ATK. They may have had somebody there, but I just wasn't able to spend time with folks from those sorts of ventures. And NASA had good representation there, a lot of folks from NASA. This meeting as you know, it has a particular emphasis on really the space science and space settlement and maybe a little bit more almost on the science fiction frontier. The Expanse panel was a very popular event. So this is different from your regular trade industry conference. And so I think that's why maybe you didn't have quite so much representation from the large aerospace companies as you might see at, for example, the Space Symposium in Colorado Springs.
In terms of the makeup of the audience, is it mostly younger people? Is it a mix? How do you assess what were about 1,000 people there?
Oh, I'm sure it was more than 1,000 in all. I don't know what the attendance was, and the demographic mix was a lot of veterans. You know, the National Space Society has a lot of people who have been involved with that group for years and years, kind of the old guard. And so you saw a lot of old guard people. And then you saw a lot of students because the National Space Society tries to do a lot with students. They had a dedicated student track And a lot of people came from, a lot of young people came from different parts of the world that they had participated in a competition for space settlement plans. And so the winners of those competitions from different parts of the world came to Los Angeles for this conference. A lot of people from Japan attended the conference. So, yeah, it was quite a mix.
Would you be able to make the assessment from having attended ISDC and many of the meetings and all of that, that the new space, sort of entrepreneurial commercial space, is definitely on solid footing and progressing and minimizing risk? Would you say it's kind of entering, could you say it's entering a more developed phase than, say, just the initial startup, let's get going phase?
I would say that, yeah, it is in the phase where there are a lot of possibilities being thrown back and forth, and a lot of people are finding ventures not only in launch but also in operations and really building that infrastructure. And so I think that a lot of entrepreneurs are entering the fray right now and trying to get that established. And I don't think it's to the point where it's super settled and everyone knows exactly what they're doing. I think it's at the point where people are really willing to try a lot of things, and they're starting to have interrelationships with other ventures. I know going back to those days of Spaceship One, I remember Jeff Grayson saying, well, you'll know that the industry has arrived when you see companies doing deals with each other, and it's not just a case of, hey, here's what we're doing, and we're not so interested in creating a supplier network. I think that we've moved on to the phase where people realize that there's a whole ecosystem, and what's our niche in that ecosystem.
Is there money available for new space? Are you picking up on the fact that funding for commercial investments, new space investments, is picking up?
I think it is. I think that there are more ventures that are starting to invest in space activities, and I think it's still a little bit slow. I'm not just going to be talking about ISDC here, but just in terms of who's investing in what, I think we're finding that there are a fair number of venture capital firms that are making their first investments in the space sector because they are recognizing that there are opportunities there. And so you still hear about people relying on angel investors to get things started. There was one little company I was talking with they're basically USC students who have started this company to manufacture things from basically upcycled carbon fiber. They get the carbon fiber waste from these aerospace companies that are doing carbon composites, and then they turn those into products ranging from skateboards to furniture to bow ties to entertainment puzzles, you know, like the sorts of puzzles we played with when we were kids. Well, some of those puzzles are now being made out of carbon fiber. So, and they're relying pretty much on angel investors. But there's a lot of activity. I don't think it's been to the point where you know, it's just totally turned into settled sort of ecosystem. I think we're in the formation phase.
Andy is in Seattle, where you are, and he says,
yeah.
Alan, are you by chance attending the New Space Conference at the end of June in Seattle?
You bet. Yeah, yeah. I hope to see you there, David. The New Space Conference, which is presented by the Space Frontier Foundation, it has gotten into this pattern where it goes back and forth between Seattle and Silicon Valley, and so this year, toward the end of June, it will be in Seattle, and I've already agreed to be on one of the panels for that conference, and so I'll look forward to seeing a lot of space show listeners up in Seattle in June.
I go when it's in the Bay Area. So I won't be there. But I've been looking at their agenda and all of their information. They don't have a lot published yet, but they're
not yet. No, but they're still kind of working all that out. In fact, they had a planning meeting while I was at ISDC, so I missed the planning meeting, and so I'm not as up to speed as I otherwise might be to know exactly what they've got going on. But I think you and I must tag team New Space, because of course I go when it's in Seattle, but I haven't traditionally gone when it's in the Bay Area. So I guess between us, we've got it all covered.
Well, it used to go in Las Vegas, and then it was in Los Angeles, and then it would go back to Las Vegas. So, but now they've settled on Silicon Valley and Seattle. So,
mm-hmm.
I think it's
a nice reflection of the growing role that the Seattle area has been taking in the space industry. Now we have Blue Origin, Stratolaunch does its testing in Mojave, but it's actually headquartered with Paul Allen's group in Seattle, and we've got Space Flight Industries, which is a growing concern in space logistics, and so we're starting to get some good activity up here. SpaceX has its satellite operation headquartered in Redmond, Washington, which is near Seattle. So I'm glad that there are more things to follow in my neck of the woods.
Listeners, there's still time if you hurry up and want to get a phone call into us, and you can do that at 1-866-687-7223. And I have what may be the last of our emails. This is Carla, and Carla is in Atlanta. And Carla says, Alan, there seems to occasionally still be a debate issue as to whether international projects are good for making progress in space or whether they slow us down and cause other problems, even though they certainly help financially. Given your coverage of space news over the year, what is your take on the necessity for going international in our space projects?
I think it's a good thing on balance just to continue to have countries engaged, and I think that the International Space Station is a good example of that, that even though the U.S.-Russian relations have a lot of problems right now, I think that the relationship between the U.S. and Russian partners on the International Space Station is really good for everyone concerned. I know that there's some question whether it was really worth it in terms of the cost and the functionality of the space station, but I think just as an international relations move, I think it was good. Actually, this came up during the talk with Jeff Bezos. We talked about the Moon Village initiative from the European Space Agency, and Jeff said he liked that approach, and I kind of see where he's coming from, is that in contrast to the International Space Station, where everything has to be very highly coordinated between the partners, with the Moon Village concept, it's not that strict. It doesn't have to be quite so coordinated that everybody can kind of do their own settlement on the moon when we get to that stage, but they can be sort of co-located in the same area. And Jeff had a funny illustration of how that works. If you're running out of eggs at your settlement, you can go to the European settlement next door and say, hey, you got some eggs? And he realized it was a humorous example, but there are certainly serious examples of, hey, do you have any power? Do you have any oxygen? Do you have any water that you can spare? Because we've run into a little problem with our settlement. And so I think that illustrates the strength of having international cooperation in space, and it helps promote the peaceful uses of outer space, and which is a big priority. You know, there's a lot of concern about potential for military activities in space, and we have to have a strong defense. I don't think anybody would take issue with that, but we do want to have the sort of world that we see in all these science fiction movies, where people do things together as one Earth, one species, and I think that we need to move in that direction as much as we can while maintaining all the things that we need to maintain to preserve national security.
You got one more email while you were answering that. And
good.
So this is from Jake in Phoenix, and he says, while you were at ISDC, were there any panels or programming, or did you pick up any information regarding the potential commercialization of the space station that is now being talked about?
Interestingly enough, I didn't pick up on a lot of that. What will happen to the space station if they make the transition that the administration wants to make toward commercial activities? There was some discussion about what alternate outposts might be, but I think that that's still a little bit up in the air what that process is going to be. And so at ISDC, I don't think that I was able to pick up on that. That may have been a topic of discussion. I couldn't be everywhere at once, but I think that I suspect that people are still trying to figure out what that's going to mean if you do have some of the functions of the International Space Station turned over to the private sector. And that'll be a very interesting development as that plays out. Of course, the White House is going to be involved in that, Congress, and there are lots of folks who either would like to take more of a role with the International Space Station, or they would like to have a successor to the space station. I think I've seen a lot more support for that, where people might might make use of a piece of the space station, but they'll have their own operation. And I'm sure that Bigelow Aerospace is going to be one of the leaders in that move.
Well, that'll be a topic for ISDC next year in Washington, D.C.
And many other forums as well, I'm sure.
Is there anything we should have talked about that we've omitted or that you wanted to add to the discussion, or any closing comments?
Well, I just think that it was like drinking from a fire hose at ISDC, that there was so much going on. My head perhaps is still spinning, but I guess that's a good thing. I guess that one of the big things that came out of it is that the space effort is not just about NASA, and that message is really sinking in. And I know, David, that you have focused for years and years and years on this move toward the commercialization of space and really doing business in space. And so I don't think that the two-year rule applies to that aspect of things anymore. I think that we're really living in that age, and so that's a good thing.
Can you take a phone call that just came in at the 11th hour?
You bet.
Okay. Hi, caller. Who are you? Where are you? And thank you for calling. Hello, caller.
Hi. Yeah, this is William Salimbian from Seattle,
okay.
Washington.
Okay.
Hi.
Oh, yeah.
So, Alan, just to end on a fun note, we heard that The Expanse was officially picked up by Amazon and renewed for season 4.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that was one of the highlights of
right. Absolutely. If you go to GeekWire, we've embedded one of the tweets from one of the cast members and Kaz. And if you play that little video that's embedded in the GeekWire story, you will just see how delighted people were to hear that news. And so between that and the session on the science of the expanse, which I still have to write up. I hope to do that in the next couple of days. It was really a celebration of that show, and it really brought the crowd to Jeff Bezos's side right off the bat when he announced that that the show was going to be picked up by Amazon. So that was just a highlight, and to see the delight on the faces of the cast when that was announced, that alone was worth the price of admission.
They had a very visceral reaction, so totally agree.
Yeah.
Thanks, Alan.
Thank you.
Alan, is the what is the science behind the expanse? Who is their science advisor?
You remember Mohawk guy? One of the people on the panel. He provided some perspective on that. I don't recall if they have a specific lead person as a science advisor, but they do rely on contacts at NASA, including astronauts, to try to get the physics right, including how you handle gravity in space. Is that they're rather careful to be able to turn on their magnetic boots if they're in a situation where they can't rely on the acceleration of the spacecraft to provide artificial gravity, for example. The one thing that they do bend the rules on is sounds in space. When you watch the show and you see spaceships flying around, you do get some sounds, and that was one of the questions that came up, that that's not totally realistic, but they said that they found that you really needed that sound to give a sense of the massiveness of spacecraft or the interaction of spacecraft, and so that was the one area where they felt that they had to bend the rules of physics and acoustics a little bit.
Interesting. Maybe I'll go on to, I don't know, it's not called pay-per-view. What is it on Comcast where you can go watch all this stuff?
On demand.
On demand,
yeah.
Maybe I'll go on demand.
The seasons are available on Sci-Fi, so that should be something that you can pick up on demand.
Maybe I'll go try to watch it all over again and see if I can get into it. A lot of people have been commenting on it, and there was a petition, I know, to save the expanse. Charles Lurio had me make an announcement one time on the show to go to the WhiteHouse.gov petition thing. They had a petition for Save the Expanse. So I know it has a big following, that's for sure.
Yeah, I would. I enjoy it, and like I say, I still have some shows to catch up on. But I found out just reading up on things that I'm a fan of Game of Thrones as well. I don't know if you are, David, but
no, I don't watch that either. So
Game of Thrones takes its inspiration from the Wars of the Roses in England. Between the factions in vying for the English throne, and the showrunner for The Expanse said that he takes his inspiration from The Guns of August, which is the story of how the miscalculations of diplomats and world leaders led to the onset of World War I. And so I think that what I love about these shows is that they're fictional, but they also give you a deeper appreciation for real-life science, real-life history, and that just adds a whole nother dimension to the enjoyment of something like The Expanse.
Absolutely. Okay, Alan, I appreciate your being with us. We will talk to you soon down the road, and thank you again. It's always great to talk with you.
The same here. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it, and hello to all the fans of the Space Show.
Thank you, and listeners, we want to thank all of you who called and sent in emails for tonight, and Alan, I'll archive this in the morning and send you all the details on it, and listeners back again on Friday and Sunday. We're back to our regular space show schedule, except there won't be a show on June 4th. But other than that, it is business as usual. Thank you all for listening. Thanks to Alan Boyle, and everybody have a great rest of the week. Good night to Alan and all of you from the space show.